From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The United States was the first modern nation, and now, make no mistake about it, the world is American in its dreams and aspirations, says 20-something prodigy Jedediah Purdy in his new book, Being America. Around the world, centuries-old traditions have been shattered in America's wake. Global markets rise and fall, liberty and violence contend. It doesn't matter if America really is an imperial power, Purdy says. What matters is that the rest of the world sees it that way. Tonight on Point, Jedediah Purdy's fresh young eyes on the world's love-hate relationship with the USA. We begin with what authorities are learning about al-Qaeda in the wake of Saturday's arrest of al-Qaeda chieftain Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. I asked him what's been gleaned so far from the arrest.
They're not talking about specifics in terms of what's been learned, but what's clear is that U.S. interrogators are questioning Khalid Sheikh Mohammed because they believe that he knows more about the al-Qaeda network and its current operations than anybody else, perhaps, even more so than bin Laden. And they're sort of in a race against time to get information out of him and out of the computers and the phones and everything else they caught.
Why a race against time, Josh?
What they're trying to do is foil any potential plots that are now underway. And they believe that if they don't move fast, the people who are linked to these plots might go underground, they might move, or they might, you know, the worst case scenario is that they might sort of move up the plans and launch the attacks now.
Are there plots underway or believed to be underway that are linked or have been linked to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed?
Well, they believe so, yes. In fact, there was an intelligence memo, a classified memo that went out February 26th, in which they're talking about that in the weeks and even the days before his arrest, that Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was orchestrating plots in the United States and elsewhere, in particular plots targeting New York and other cities in which al-Qaeda operatives might seize gas trucks and drive them into the gas pumps at gas stations to attack bridges, things of that nature.
We heard this idea of slashing the cables on suspension bridges. Those cables don't look easily slashed. That sounds like a major explosives undertaking.
Either that or it might be one of their more harebrained schemes. I mean, we're not saying that everything they do is necessarily deadly. I was kind of wondering about that myself. It could be explosives. I mean, I think they were talking about detonating bridges, too. But the thing you have to remember is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is linked to almost all of their major attacks over the last 10 years, dating back to the first World Trade Center bombing, which ironically was almost 10 years to the day before Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's arrest.
And describe his role for us.
He's more of an operational planner. We just did a very, very long profile of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and described him as sort of the engineer of the al-Qaeda network. I mean, bin Laden himself is more of a visionary and a big thinker, chairman of the board, for instance, of a major corporation, whereas Khalid Sheikh Mohammed would be the chief executive officer. He's the guy that gets things done. He's the one that links the big thinkers on the board, as it were, with the soldiers on the ground and the mid-level managers and the commanders.
So could have been the one who thought, hey, box cutters and passenger jetliners, and we've got a combination here.
Right. Well, they believe that he is the guy that went to bin Laden with the idea of flying planes into buildings. I mean, he was indicted in New York in a grand jury for his role in a plot from 1995 to detonate bombs on 12 airliners flying over the Pacific, U.S. airliners. He also had discussed in the mid-90s flying a plane into CIA headquarters. So they believe that the whole idea behind 9/11 probably came from Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. In fact, I think he's taken credit for it in an interview with Al Jazeera.
We've seen conflicting reports of exactly how he was apprehended. Was this a Pakistani operation, a joint U.S.-Pakistani operation? What do we know? What's coming out?
This is always the case. That was the case with Abu Zubaydah and other people that are big-time al-Qaeda operatives. President Musharraf of Pakistan has to walk a very thin line between helping the United States and also appeasing the militants in his own country. So he doesn't want to make it seem like it was a U.S. operation. He wants to make it seem like it was a Pakistan operation.
But we want to know what it really was. What do you know, Josh Meyer?
Well, I mean, it was a CIA-Pakistan operation. The way it's been described to me by people that were actually involved in the raid is that, as is the case before, the CIA and sometimes the FBI provide the intelligence. They'll provide the information that's needed to find somebody. They'll say, this guy is in this house right now. And then the Pakistan Intelligence Service, the Inner Services Intelligence Agency, will knock down the doors, you know, guns blazing, and go in and arrest people. And the CIA and at times the FBI will be, as they like to put it, around the corner. In this case, what I'm told is that the Pakistan intelligence officers, who are very good, by the way, went in, guns drawn, took these guys down without much of a fight, and then that the CIA was on the scene within minutes.
In addition to Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, what do we know about material that was gathered there?
Well, I talked to some authorities today. I spent a lot of time yesterday talking to them and reported today that that they believe that they have potentially found a treasure trove of information in there about Al-Qaeda plots, operatives around the world, and even how the network operates. Today, they're confirming that they're continuing to find indications that that is the case. In fact, one person described it to me as a potential mother load of information about Al-Qaeda.
It's hard to imagine that they'd have spreadsheets outlining by name and address and time every operation underway and sort of instructions on how to pick up these operatives.
Well, it is, and that's why I'm a bit skeptical. But the thing you have to remember about Khalid Sheikh Mohammed is they really do believe that he was orchestrating many, many plots around the world. He's been linked to the Bali bombing, which occurred last year and killed almost 200 people. He's been linked to directly to the Tunisian bombing, in which almost 20 people were killed at a synagogue. And so he's keeping track of a lot of things. He's also known to the intelligence people as a technophile, I guess is the word, where you know he likes computers and cell phones and other technological gadgets. So it is possible that he did have a lot of information in there.
Do we know where they're aiming right now in terms of tracking down, running down these sleeper cells you referred to at the top of our conversation?
That's a very, very closely held secret. And the one thing that I would mention, too, is these computers were found in his possession, but there were two other people with him as well. We still don't know definitively whose computers they were, but they're very optimistic that there's a lot of information in them. But what they're not saying is what they're finding in that information, you know, whether or not they found like a sleeper cell in Detroit, for instance, or one in Brussels or Paris or something like that. That is very closely held information because they're trying to arrest these people or at least monitor them right now before they can be tipped off to this. In fact, they tried to keep the raid secret for at least 24 hours, and I'm told that some of the U.S. Intelligence officials are very upset that the Pakistanis announced Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's arrest because they were hoping to act
on it before it became public,
I guess. Act on it, yeah. I mean, somebody described it to me as flipping on the light switch in a dark kitchen and seeing all the cockroaches scatter. Mm-hmm. You got to get them before they, you know, make it to the corners of the room.
Do we know where Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's being held now and who is interrogating him?
Again, that's a very, very closely held secret. I would guess he's in Afghanistan at Bagram Air Force Base or something like that, or at the Diego Garcia base, or on a ship in international waters. That doesn't mean, however, that the Pakistan officials are not helping the interrogation. It's probably a joint effort, but he is clearly in the custody of the United States, and I'm sure they're working him very hard. I'm sure they haven't let him sleep since his arrest.
Josh Meyer, thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Josh Meyer covers terrorism for the Los Angeles Times. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. In 1999, Jedediah Purdy made a huge splash on the cultural scene with his first book, For Common Things. Now, at the ripe old age of 28, he's diving into the deep, murky waters of geopolitics and global culture. After the terrorist attacks of 9/11, Purdy set off on a journey around the world to try to understand, in his words, the imitation and rejection that America inspires so widely. He's back, a little older, wiser, and with a new book, Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. In it, Jedediah Purdy says America was the first modern nation, and much of the world wants to emulate it. But whenever the U.S. acts in a fashion that is ignorant, opportunistic, or arrogant, it weakens the case for America's version of the future. His insights come at a critical moment. The world has largely lined up in opposition to the U.S. over war with Iraq. Millions of protesters have taken to the streets. On many fronts, Uncle Sam is getting a drubbing. America's power is great. Its control is less clear. How do you read world affection and world animosity toward the USA today? Are you sympathetic with the world's misgivings or just fed up? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight in the studio is Jedediah Purdy, author of the new book, Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. Good evening and welcome, Jedediah Purdy.
Hi.
It's great to have you with us here.
Great to be here.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point's news analyst, Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello, Mr. Purdy.
Hi, Jack.
Jedediah Purdy, you took off after 9/11. You were in any number of countries. Egypt, I know. Indonesia.
India, China, Thailand, Cambodia. Those were the chief stops.
So you really went out to take the temperature. What was your goal exactly?
Well, the trip was actually planned before September 11th and was part of a project I'd been working on from the spring of that year. The goal was to try to see firsthand how it is that that America, the idea of America in the eyes of the mm-hmm. world, mm-hmm. is both a lightning rod for anger and resentment and a magnet for ambition and emulation, as it seemed to me from standing in the United States and watching both discussions about globalization before September 11th and then the politics afterward, that both of these attitudes were real and that they were coming from the same places at the same times and mixed up together in some sort of confusing knot. And I wanted to talk to the people who were feeling these things and try to see where the passions were coming from.
You got a very, very big lightning bolt then when on September 11th, this was the negative passion in about as big an exclamation mark as we
yes.
could ever have.
Yes.
Jedediah Purdy, your voice and story are a fascinating one. Of course, the folklore is the West Virginia homeschooled boy and up through Harvard and Yale and published very early on, the kind of wet behind the ears voice of youth. But looking at you tonight, I don't see a kid who probably did his arithmetic on the back of a shovel, and you're clearly not so straight out of short pants anymore by any means. But still, there's something in your youth that makes us particularly interested in what you saw when you went out. You say that as Americans, we live in an American world, more than citizens of Imperial Rome inhabited a Roman world, or 19th century Englishmen a British world. Make your case there.
What I mean is, first of all, the obvious, that wherever you go, American culture is the common currency of casual conversation. People in Jakarta and Cairo and Beijing recognize Michael Jordan's face. They've heard Britney Spears' music. Some of them can discuss NBA standings. The second level is that we've provided the form that people are using to transform their own local cultures. So if you go, at the time I was in China last year, for instance, the number one song on the Chinese popular airwaves was a Chinese nationalist hip-hop song. So,
great.
So it's local in its content, but
it's
got our
shape.
The envelope is American.
Mm-hmm.
And the third thing is a deeper sense still, I think. And that's that the whole world is coming into a condition that people used to call, though they stopped using the term a few decades ago for incidental reasons, modernity. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that is just the features of ordinary life that we take for granted. That what becomes of you in your life has more to do with your choice and aptitude and luck than it has to do with who your parents are or where you were born. That what you come to believe about the world and your place in it has as much to do with your explorations and inspiration as with an inherited tradition. That where you'll end up living is what you'll end up doing and believing, maybe thousands of miles, literally and metaphorically, from your parents and your grandparents.
And since America got there first to modernity, we are the great exemplar.
Yes. We're the first modern nation, and we're also, in the eyes of the world, the great example of successful modernity. Rich, secure, powerful. It's true, as the president likes to say, that people everywhere want security, material comfort, a sense that their families are going somewhere, and we are the image of that, inescapably.
But modernity also rips up cultures a mile a minute, Jack Beatty, and we know that it's not all love and kisses out there for the USA.
No, someone once said that America is the euthanasia of memories, and that's happened here with our immigrants, of course. The whole notion of assimilation is forget about it. And it's happening all over the world. Modernity is also people being cut off from their traditions, feeling mm-hmm. isolated, alone, fragmented. And that's part of the condition of modernity, too. And I think it's what people recognize as America.
Yes.
We're taking a big, big view tonight with Jedediah Purdy at the world's love-hate relationship with America. It matters. Towers can fall. Pentagons can be run into. Wars can be started. Alliances made or broken. Billions of personal decisions around this world on the basis of that impression of the United States of America. How do you read world affection and world animosity toward the USA today? Is America putting the best face on modernity? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
from Boston.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Jedediah Purdy about the world's love-hate relationship with America. He's out with a new book entitled Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. He's famously homeschooled, famously through Harvard and Yale, a very young published viewer, analyst of the world, now bringing his impressions from a post-9/11 trip around the world of what that world makes of this country at this critical juncture. Are you sympathetic to the world's misgivings about America, or are you fed up with them? How do you imagine you would see America if you were, say, a poor, young Egyptian? And how do you read world affection and world animosity toward the United States today? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jedediah Purdy, take us out into that world. Give us two or three anecdotes of interactions you had that illustrate how you see the world seeing us.
Yes. One pattern I saw again and again, and particularly in my Islamic stops from Egypt halfway around the world to Indonesia, was young people who in some respects were fiercely, perfectly, beautifully westernized, and in other respects, terrifyingly radical and fundamentalist in their sympathies. I had Mocha Madness mud pies at a TGI Fridays in Cairo on a floating boat along the Nile, with a young Egyptian woman, a corporate lawyer, and her two sisters who were in law school and medical school, respectively. Fashionably turned out, they looked like Western club girls. They were telling me about their social lives, telling me about their professional lives, which were much more like Western than like traditional Egyptian existences. Long hours, ambition. Their fathers were very concerned that they were at the office late at night, but for them, being working, moving, cosmopolitan people was part of their identity. And then one of them got out her cell phone and wanted to show me a text message that all of her stylish friends had been beaming around that day. And the message was, dance party. The name of the dance party was Bombs in the World Trade Center. The advertised DJ in the next line of the text was DJ Osama bin Laden. And the corporate sponsor was fly-in courtesy of American Airlines.
In other words, a joke made of 9/11.
Yes, a joke made of 9/11, but also it delighted them. It wasn't macabre humor of the kind you might have had here, like post-Columbia disaster jokes about body parts. It was delightful. I didn't laugh, and the lawyer
this
was
is
the most
sort of tweaking the nose of the tiger who's taken a blow.
That's exactly right. They explained to me, for us, Osama bin Laden is a hero because he's the one who hit the United States, which is the symbol of everything that's powerful and unmoving and uninterested in us, even as it's the symbol of everything they're becoming in their own lives.
So how can they be simultaneously living in the clothes, the mindset, the pace, in some senses the worldview of the U.S., and at the same time be so opposed, even to the point of cruelty?
I think there are two ways of thinking about it, at least. One is that there are two kinds of things that people want. One is what we were talking about earlier. They want security, they want comfort, they want to know that they're not going to starve. The other is that they want respect, status, and dignity. And I think for a lot of people who feel that they're on the margins of the world that they're moving into, and they belong and don't belong at the same time to this changing world, that the fantasy of a powerful, zealous figure slamming into the symbol of American power is satisfying, even though it runs contrary to the way they actually lead their lives. Think of a young radical in the 70s, here in the States, for instance, on the one hand doing, very practical community or civil rights work, and on the other hand, he has a poster of Mao or Che Guevara up on his wall. And this is, on the one hand, it's signing on to a program of violence and upheaval and destruction, but on the other, it's just a symbol of defiance. It's like a Malcolm X hat, maybe. It's serving some of that kind of role.
You're right, Jedediah Purdy. We are on stage at the center of the world, and in others' eyes, we are what they want us to be, what they fear that we are, what they want to become, and what they loathe in themselves. They loathe in themselves. What's that?
Yeah. What gives people a feeling of unending discomfort is belonging and not belonging at the same time to the world they've decided to join. It's the feeling that becoming westernized is both an achievement and a triumph and becoming more yourself, and also a betrayal and an abandonment of what you were born as, what your parents were, and what you were expected to become. And it's the feeling that even as you've left behind one world, you can only belong imperfectly in the new world that you've moved into. It's the sense of imperfect fit in your own life. Mm-hmm. And I think the fantasy of political radicalism, the revolutionary, the destructive fantasy, it's often connected psychologically in all kinds of times and places to this feeling and the desire to have everything in the world resolved and made simple in a single act of violence and defiance. It resolves all the tensions people have to live in.
Jack Beattie, I think we're lucky to have Jedediah Purdy at his age out in the world making these observations of peers in age very often who are still very much groping for their own, to define their own aspirations and feeling that tension of modernity and traditional expectations keenly.
Yes, and I'm heartened by his comparison to radical posters of the 70s, that this was a kind of dress. It was a kind of cultural sign. It didn't mean that it didn't portend that this was going to be the future for these people. In fact, many Wall Street lawyers, I'm sure, had Che Guevara posters. And so if that's what Islamicism or whatever you want to call it is for many of these young people, that's a comforting thought.
But there must be a spectrum here, don't you think? I mean, because we know that there's real recruiting and real terrorism being.
Of course.
Right. But, you know, there's another way of framing this. This is the way Ben Barber frames it, that the world is coming apart and coming together at the same time. And he puts it in terms of it's Mac world versus jihad. Mm-hmm. We are Mac world. We are one standard, as Mr. Purdy says. We're the network society. You got to speak English. You want to do business. We're Microsoft. And jihad is the reaction of people whose identities, as he says, are threatened by this new cosmopolitan Macworld. And then that the more Macworld, it's almost as if the more jihad. And these are very frightening developments. And what they both share in common is that neither of them are democratic. And they're both profoundly hostile to democracy. Macworld, because it's all about money and inequality and rationalization in the economic sense. Jihad, because it's all about identity and expressing my tribal thing and not yours. So I want to believe in those posters, but I also fear this confrontation between Macworld and jihad and this dialectic going on for a long time.
We're talking tonight with Jedediah Purdy. His new book is Being America. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. Let's turn to them. David's on the line. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How are you tonight?
Good, thanks.
Yeah, I wanted to make the point that I think that what we're seeing in the world at large is kind of an internationalization of a dynamic that's happening right here domestically for a long time. I mean, one of the reasons we're such a violent culture is that we have this concept that we have a very open society, a society where people can participate and excel, but it's not really true for a lot of people. And so one way to participate, if you're one of the many failures in the society, failures that are necessitated by the way the society operates, is that you can participate by being an outlaw, by attacking the establishment, the way things are, and I think that that's what's now happening on a larger scale.
Well, are you suggesting that that's an American export, David?
Oh yeah, it's part of an export because, you know, within the same culture that celebrates success and celebrates achievement in a free society. It's not accidental that we're fascinated by the rebellious character, you know, the outlaw, the killer, even the psychopath.
David, hold that thought, because this is a point that Jedediah Purdy goes to in some substance and detail. I want to get his response.
Well, I think
this tension, Jedediah, of liberty and opportunity,
yes,
and violence, and the dynamic that they dance in.
Yes, I think that's absolutely. I think what David says is right. If you think of it this way, people will go to the sources of dignity and respect that they see as open to them. And if that means opening a little shop or going to English lessons at night, they'll do that. And if that means joining the local Hindu nationalist brigade or the local or the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt or a nationalist social organization in China, they're going to do that.
So you're saying when that wind hits them of opportunity and uprooting simultaneously, they're going to grab on to whatever's available.
Yes.
For dignity and respect. Interesting,
yes,
words.
So when we were talking about the spectrum with Jack, and this goes to David's point, one of the things I found most interesting in the time abroad was constant reminders that the spectrum now is a spectrum of possibility. It hasn't set in its shape for the young people I spoke to. These are people who flip from sentence to sentence between saying, I support the victory of Osama bin Laden, and I would love to come to the United States and have a job, and I'm so glad to see an American like you here, and give me a call if you need anything.
Because if they can have it all and make a friend, they'd love to, but if they can't?
If they can't, then they go the other way, perhaps. And this is where the role the U.S. plays in the world matters very much. Take one of many instances. Indonesia's Islamist politics, mm-hmm, became more radical, more virulent, and more effective after the Indonesian economy collapsed as a result of, partly of one of the major dysfunctions of a very rapid liberalizing economic program that broke down all the barriers to capital movement, and then they had a capital crisis.
And this is a pattern we know well. We saw it ourselves when fascism grew during the Great Depression.
Yes, yes, exactly. This is not new. We saw in Europe in the 20th century that the great possibility, the great political and social forms that rising modernity has taken have been liberal democracy, social democracy, and fascism.
You, David, raises a point which or gets us into an area that you make much of. You key a lot of the book, This Is Being America, off of Edmund Burke, the philosopher, and his view of this tension of liberty and violence sort of baked into democracy,
yes,
and modernism. Mm. Why?
Burke is a fascinating figure to me because he, like a lot of thinkers of his period, the late 18th century, wasn't an academic philosopher. He was a practitioner of politics and a participant in public life. He comes down to us as a conservative because he was one of the great critics of the French Revolution, but he was also the first and one of the greatest anti-imperialists in British history. Of an adamant opponent of British Empire in India, and a man who devoted 14 years of his life to trying to lighten and ultimately lift the British yoke from India. And he was a figure who I think had, how to put it, he had a moral and political worldview that came before all the great ideologies of the 19th and 20th centuries, the fights among communism and fascism and liberalism, and was keyed to an essential moral core that he saw very clearly at the beginning of modernity, modern politics, revolution, empire, and social upheaval, which was that human nature naturally stands on a very thin blade between what he called liberty, which meant social relations that tended to mutual respect and dignity, and violence, which meant domination and tyranny and harm as ordinary features of social life. He said that people love these. People love to feel powerful and have unchecked power, mm-hmm, over other people. And that once you start in that cycle of social relations, it gets very bad very quickly.
But you make the point that,
yes,
here we are at the beginning of the 21st century, and you say, and I quote, we are confronting not two global tribes, but two tendencies within every,
yes,
civilization and soul, one liberal and the other illiberal, one tending, in Burke's words, to liberty, the other to violence, in the eyes of the world. Where does the United States stand in that bipolarity?
That's the fascinating thing, that we are both at once. On the one hand, we are the best possibility for a free existence, free in the sense that's relevant to the ordinary lives of people struggling and broken and upturned circumstances. On the other hand, we are associated everywhere, and especially in the Arab Middle East, with imperialism, opportunism, militarism. And part of this is because as the biggest guy in the world, inevitably we will attract whatever resentments are out there, and they will come to us no matter what we do. But the other part of it is that we are persistently obtuse and arrogant and inconsistent in what we do and in the relation between what we do and what we say. And the world watches that very closely.
We're not a transparently democratic influence at every moment.
And we do, and we're ham-handed, I mean. We do stupid things. We don't see the world clearly.
Jack Beattie, it's easy to respond to Jedediah's analysis there, that the world looking on as America prepares for war, but in the name of liberty, and feel that tension.
Oh, yeah, we're going to go out for domination in the name of liberty. There's the paradox coming together in what's called foreign policy. But, you know, just in the past week, I was struck with two little shards of the past that probably throw light on how people see us in the world, at least in corners of the world. Our Marines were talking about going onto the island of Jolo in the Philippines. Mm-hmm. Well, on that island in about 1910, General Leonard Wood massacred about 600 Filipino women and children. And then there was another item from Laos. Every year in Laos, 6,000 people die from the bombs we dropped there in a secret war that went on for over 15 years. 6,000 people a year, kids, women, old farmers. This is what we've done in the world, you know, and we hide from it. And we were conceived in hypocrisy. And the inability of Americans to face up to their history, which is about what you expect from a big, powerful country, mm-hmm. I think is one of our big liabilities in the world. It sort of pickles us in innocence. And the rest of the world looks at it and they gag at the hypocrisy.
Jedediah Purdy writes about that pickled innocence a little bit. We'll come back and talk about that. We're talking tonight with Jedediah Purdy, author of the new book, Being America. You can join the conversation. Do you agree? There's a global struggle between liberty and violence. Which side is winning? Which side is America pushing? Does America provide the global language of dreams and the global imagery of ambition? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
From Boston University.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with author Jedediah Purdy about the world's love-hate relationship with the United States. He's author of a new book, Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. Do you agree that there's a global struggle between liberty, liberalism, and violence? Which side is winning? Which side is America pushing? And how do you imagine you would see America if you were a poor, young Egyptian, are you sympathetic to the world's misgivings about America, or are you fed up with them? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Winston's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Winston. You're on the air.
Yes, good evening. It's a very fascinating topic. This is the point I want to make, and that is that the author has gone around, and it's very interesting to hear the account, but he, it appears, has spoken mostly to the elites of these countries, you know, sipping mocha and going on cell phones, etc. But what about the half of the world's population, 3 billion, living on $2 a day, mm-hmm. and apparently 2 billion living on $1 a day? Do you think they're thinking about America salivating? Yes, perhaps they would like to come here, but they are worried about the next scrap of food or how they're going to put a roof over their head. And let me ask you this challenging question.
Yes.
Where do you, How do you see America showing leadership here? Because this is where it really counts. And just to digress into the last discussion last hour,
yes,
you know, there was 90% of people in Turkey saying no, and yet we're kind of fumbling around with the whole issue, well, three votes or this or that, which party, this party. Can't we see the big picture?
Winston, I want to ask you, though, when you say that you've got this huge volume of poor who are thinking about the next meal, the next day, not about this the metaphysical implication of the United States as emblem of modernity, does that mean that they're relevant or irrelevant to the kind of global conversation that Jedediah is describing?
I don't think they care. They are worried about survival, and perhaps they may have some ideas about the United States, but that's not relevant. I mean, this group is growing, and if we do not find ways of these to have democratic institutions take them into account, we will do so, I believe, in my humble opinion, at our peril.
Winston, we've got it, and it's a great area that you open. Jedediah, we can. Well, I guess first, to your experience with the affluent crust and the totally unaffluent majority, and then how do these tiers interact? The great mass, billions, depending on that $1 or $2 a day, that kind of intermediary class that you describe, which does interact through media and mobility with America.
There are at least three things to say. I guess the first one is that I tried to talk to as many different sorts of people as I could in wandering, shopkeepers, pedestrians in bazaars, people at mosques, people in the neighborhoods in Bombay, Mumbai, and India, where the Shiv Sena, which are one of the most significant and interesting Indian nationalist, chauvinist, street-fighting, quasi-fascist organizations work. So I talked about the Egyptian upper crust because the paradox is most poignant for us there, because they're so much like us and unlike us. The second thing is that I think there are at least two ways that this discussion is directly linked to the poorest of the poor, as we say. The first is that in democratic countries like India, the votes of that population, even though they're often manipulated, bought, beaten out of people and so on, increasingly, with every decade, with every election, are more independent, matter more. And those have very much to do with the way that India's politics has spiraled more and more into extremes in a complicated
becoming
way.
Becoming more democratic and more extreme.
More democratic and more extreme, which shouldn't surprise us. at the same time, even in countries where the universal vote is not a fact yet, the fate of the poorest of the poor depends very much on whether the political direction those countries take embraces, to use the simple compass for the moment, a greater share of liberty or a greater share of violence. Is it going to be about a quasi-fascist assertion of an imagined collective identity against our enemies? Or is it going to be about the attempt to build something that benefits everyone? That's another respect in which these are interlinked problems.
Let me ask about that, and I guess going to the point of whether Winston's correct that the image, the idea of America is relevant or irrelevant there. You describe a very poor Coptic Christian family that you dined with where there weren't enough utensils to go around, where you had the only bowl. You write, and we could feel resentment and hurt in that family and in others that you describe. You write that resentment and hurt, like aspiration, run to America, the country that offers to the mind and heart everything that real life denies the hand and mouth. But how far down into the pyramid of poverty is that relevant?
It's probably worth saying that although this family would have seemed desperately poor by American standards, by Egyptian standards they were probably lower middle class, and by the standards of the world they weren't living in the streets and they weren't living in a thatch hut. In India they would clearly have been lower middle or middle class. But I think actually the image of America and the desire and resentment that attach to it run quite far down the pyramid. You can be bumping along a dirt road in rural India on a holiday and see a little hut off by the side of the road, and the whole village is gathered around watching a movie on one person's TV. The pervasiveness of these images is something new in the last 10 years, 15 years, and we're only beginning to understand the extent of its effects.
Jack, are you there?
Yeah, I was just going to say, to Winston's point about, you know, what does the United States' connection to this mass poverty, 25,000 American cotton farmers receive more in agricultural subsidies from our government than we give through our AID budget to the whole continent of Africa. 25,000 Americans. And those farmers, because we subsidize the cotton, do out Africans of their more of their cheaper cotton because the price is subsidized and therefore it can be lower than what they can afford to make. So do we care about these people?
And do we care about American cotton farmers? Martha's calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Hi, Martha. You're on the air.
Hi, good evening.
Good evening.
One of the things that you were talking about this evening reminded me of something I learned in college called capitalism and underdevelopment. At the time, it was a kind of controversial theory in which, in order for our country to be so wealthy, to have so many products at a low price, that these had to be produced in poorer countries and that it maintained a disequilibrium, that there would have to be very, very poor people in order for us to remain so wealthy.
So this disadvantage for them was advantageous to the system, you're saying?
Correct. And what Jedediah is talking about kind of makes me think of a social parallel to that economic model. And I'm wondering if you could speak about whether or not, in order for us to have a democratic or republic institution, we've maintained a lot of dictatorships throughout the world. And that kind of makes a parallel of that economic model.
We've got it. Thanks, Martha. Jedediah.
Yes. certainly it's true that in places where we want cheap natural resources, and oil is the best example, we've been comfortable and even eager in propping up regimes that get us that on terms that are more or less favorable to us. But I think in the case of manufacturing, for instance, modern industry, you actually see a much more complicated situation. I spent some time, for instance, in Phnom Penh, Cambodia, among workers in garment factories outside the city. And I saw three things happening at once. On the one hand, people were working for very, very low wages, $40 a month, you know. They were paying $10 a month for a tiny little hut and rent and sending $10 back to the village, and some of the rest went for a cell phone or for payments on a scooter. And there's no question our shoes cost somewhat less for this reason. The other thing I saw happening there was that these factories had become centers of labor organizing that was also political organizing and was one of the more promising efforts to turn a very young and very fragile Cambodian democracy into a working democracy with institutions of civil society. And some of the extraordinary leaders were just women from villages who were in their first years of their first paying jobs in these factories and turned out to be civic leaders.
So there's the tension working both ways, working for next to nothing, but in the process coming into an environment where they might be politically organized toward democratic empowerment.
Yes, and if you go into those villages at night, the little slum villages where the factory workers work, you will see, and it astonished me, little schoolrooms where people are paying a fifth of their monthly salary to take English lessons every night for 2 hours after they end the day in the factory.
Is this the American magnet?
It is the American magnet. So all three of these things are happening at once. You've got what's objectively exploitation, you've got individual opportunity, and you've got democratic mobilization, and they're all tied up together.
Martha, thanks for your call. Brad's calling from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. Hi, Brad. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that as a person who lives in America, I think that the American citizens are unreasonably or maybe even unnecessarily buffered by our media, as far as our own national centrism, our egocentrism. We don't see so much of the struggle, the pain of the world, so to speak, in these third world countries. You know, they're living hand to mouth, you know, $2 a month, whatever it is. But here we can sit here and we can see the scripted violence on TV. We can, you know, lounge in our own, we can just wallow in our own materialism.
And look down our very long media nose. It's a good point, Brad. Thanks for making it. And Jedediah, you raise this, really. You describe the U.S. in the eyes of history, perhaps, and much of the world as a kind of fabled paradise that we take for granted.
That we take for granted, and in which, as Jack said, we tend to forget that the rest of the world exists, and if we remember that it exists, to forget that people's lives there are every bit as complicated and messy and rich and confused in possibility as ours are. When we remember it exists, we tend to imagine it in either of two ways. Either they're just waiting to become us, they're on their way to get here, or they're barbarians who hate us and despise everything we stand for and want to tear us apart. And none of those ideas will help us to understand what's going on out there or to act effectively.
Our time is short. You write very interestingly about the future. You say, on the one hand, today's world is American because it is taking the shape of the modernity that we pioneered. But then you say, there is no guarantee of an American future. It is naive to believe that the migratory icons of American modernity, constitutions, regular elections, free markets, shopping malls, MTV, will turn every place to a version of what we already are. What awaits us is not restricted to what we wish for or even what we can imagine. What do you mean?
I guess the simplest answer is Chinese nationalist hip-hop. China's a country whose political system has great potential to produce a kind of nationalist fascism in the next 80 years. It also has great potential to produce something like the beginnings of a liberal democracy.
How does America influence which way that goes?
It's hardest to say in China, because China, more than the Middle East, even more than India, is its own thing. But a great part of the answer is that the more we're seen as determined to be and remain the only great nation, which in military terms and to a certain extent in economic and ideological terms is now, according to this statement of national security policy,
it is the policy
the Bush
of the
administration's
land.
Aim. Exactly. We set ourselves up as a target for every demagogue in any of these places who wants to ride the unstable, fast winds of young democracy and new popular politics by turning people's anger against something big and powerful that they think is contemptuous of them. So the more arrogant and the more self-certain we are and the more we say, bring it on, the more we're going to get it.
Jedediah Purdy, thank you so much for being with
thank
us tonight.
You.
It's been just great having you.
It's been a lot of fun.
Jedediah Purdy, the famously homeschooled West Virginian, has been out in the world. He's brought us Being America, Liberty, Commerce, and Violence in an American World. Jack Beatty, there's a lot to chew on here.
There is, and I strongly recommend the book. It's a fresh look at the world, but a very complicated one. I mean, Mr. Purdy sees three things going on at once where most of us just see one, and that kind of complexity and that eye for it is rare.
Jack, thanks for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're funded